This podcast is brought to you by Knowledge at Wharton.
The European Union has been a unique partnership to deal with trade and currency differences, along with free migration between the nations. But the euro, the common currency of the region, turned 20 earlier this year. When it started back in 1999, it was seen as a way of bringing 28 countries with vastly different economies together. But that was a, quote, economic folly, end quote, according to our next guest, Ashok Modi. Mr. Modi is a visiting professor in international economic policy at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, as well as a former deputy director in the research and European departments at the International Monetary Fund. And as the United Kingdom inches toward a new Brexit deadline, we see some of the political divisions that continue to divide the European Union. Though it should be noted that Britain was one European Union country that never adopted the euro. Mr. Modi's book is titled Euro Tragedy, A Drama in Nine Acts. It's currently available in hardcover with the paperback due out next year. Professor, great to have you with us today. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. What is your sense of the European Union right now as we have these back and forth with the United Kingdom right now?
The European Union is going through a very troubled phase right now at many different levels. As you correctly made a distinction between the euro, which is the single currency, and broadly the European Union. In my view, both are going through a very difficult period. The euro, because it has its own longstanding problems of being a single currency without a nation state, and the European Union, because although I believe the European Union was absolutely a benign project in the post-war years, it has reached a point where it is beginning to reach diminishing returns and is therefore creating enormous conflicts amongst nations.
So what then do you see as the potential future here? Because at least on the euro side, let's start there, to be able to get 28 countries together on one kind of economic policy is an incredibly hard challenge.
Yes, and when I started writing my book, the question I asked myself is, why does this animal exist? And I looked into the history. I went back to the origins of what we now call the European Union in 1950, and I realized that the idea cropped up sometime around 1970, and from that moment till the euro was created in 1999, 30 years, every important economist in the world said this is a really bad idea. And not only the economists, but even the political scientists said this is a bad idea because of what you are intimating through your question. A single currency, by definition, is a case of one size that fits none. So you have Germany and Italy in the same currency union. The monetary policy is too easy for Germany. It's too tight for Italy. As Karl Otto Pohl, who was Bundesbank president in 1988, said, a single currency makes the strong stronger, the weak weaker. That is by the nature of the currency. A single monetary policy will always increase divergence. And the more countries you have, the more divergence it will create.
But because you are 20 years into this now, are you too far down the road to be able to make a drastic change in this idea of having the euro and its level of importance throughout all of those countries?
Right. So let's break this up into two parts. The leadership that went ahead with the euro did understand that they needed to complement the euro with other things. And the crucial other thing over here is what economists call a fiscal union. Mm-hmm. So in the United States, you have a single currency, the dollar, and there is a federal government which transfers implicitly or explicitly fiscal resources between states. So if Nevada goes into a recession, there's an automatic process of tax reductions from Nevada to the federal government. There are transfers of spending that go to Nevada. And so in the Great Recession between 2007 and 2009, something of the order of 20% of Nevada GDP was transferred into that state to help it deal with its crisis. You probably never heard of this,
right?
Because this is part of the DNA of how the system works. In contrast that with what happened in the European Union when there was a crisis in 2010 and Greece needed a bailout. There was so much drama around it, and that drama not only elevated the sense of financial panic, but in the end caused Greece enormous amount of austerity from which it has not recovered. It went to a near depression with a 25% GDP loss. So the system required at that point a substantial fiscal transfer to Greece, but that idea is abhorrent to those who might have to make that transfer. And so it created a currency without the system of fiscal transfers, what we call a fiscal union. But the word at the start was, don't worry about it. We are Europeans. Mm-hmm. Goodwill and good sense will eventually create a fiscal union. But as you say, 20 years have passed. In fact, I would say 50 years have passed,
right,
because the conception was in 1970. And the notion that Europe needed a fiscal union alongside the single currency has been known for half a century. Then in 2017, Emmanuel Macron becomes president of France. And one of the first things he says is that we need a fiscal union. We need a central Eurozone budget. We are now 2 years into the Macron presidency. That idea has disappeared. Why? Because a system of nations, 28 independent nations, have conflicting national interests. And that conflict not only has not ebbed with time, in fact, in many ways, it has become aggravated because the fear that I may have to use my tax resources to bail out the Italians is simply not acceptable to the so-called northern countries.
And there will never be, I think, a drastic change on that mindset. That is something that is probably going to be there for as long as the European Union continues on, correct?
Absolutely. So often senior European leaders will tell me, they'll pat me on the back and say, look, you don't understand. We are Europeans. We see the history over here. This is not a matter of 20 years. You're judging this in too short a time horizon. This is a 100-year project. We will get to that.
Right.
They will say to me, just look, for example, at the United States. The United States took a long time to create a monetary union. But the history there, the Europeans narrate about America, they have got it backwards. America started very much in many ways like what the European Union is, between the War of Independence and the Constitution. Those 8 or 10 years, the U.S. was a confederation of states. European Union is a confederation of states. What James Madison understood at the time, he was actually a proponent of the idea of confederation of states, but he realized very quickly how deep the conflicts were. There's an incident that is particularly germane to this discussion where the New York State says, we collect the import duties. Now, why exactly will we share that with the federal government?
Right.
And that is, in a sense, the problem. And Madison realized, look, this is not going to work out because the federal government has to pay the war debts. And if these guys don't share, we have a problem. So they create a constitution. And so America starts with a constitution, a federal government with coercive tax powers, with right to regulate interstate commerce, with a right to a standing army. And then it takes a bloody civil war before they begin to think of monetary union. So the history is that you forge a nation state, and then in that nation state, you create a political contract, which then becomes the basis of a fiscal union. That's the historical trajectory. Europeans have tried to go exactly opposite, in the opposite direction of the history.
You're listening to Knowledge at Wharton here on Sirius XM 132, Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Dan Loney in our studios here in Philadelphia, joined by Ashok Modi of Princeton University. We're talking about the state of Europe, the euro, and Professor Modi's book, Euro Tragedy, A Drama in Nine Acts. Again, you're listening to Sirius XM 132, Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. So to a degree, it would seem when you try to correlate those two, what happened in the United States all those years ago and what is going on here in Europe, it does feel like there's a bit of a war going on in Europe, maybe without the blood part of it.
Well, look, you know, you're invoking an image which is very troubling, obviously, and I understand why you're doing it.
Right.
I mean, I can say to you, though, that there were serious people, including Marty Feldstein at Harvard, a very important economics professor, passed away recently, who said exactly what you're saying. He says, look, you've constructed this to avoid war. I mean, the whole point of Europe, modern Europe, post-war modern Europe, is to avoid bloody wars. But you're creating a system that's going to be so divisive that you will actually come to blows with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So we're mercifully nowhere close to that. But you can see this all the time. You know, for example, the whole migration issue has become so divisive. Matteo Salvini is constantly having battles with the French and just this morning with the Germans on what to do with migrants coming into Europe. Is very acrimonious. You know, he's holding up ships and keeping the migrants in the docks. And the others then accuse the Italians of inhumane behavior. And Salvini says, well, if you are so humane, why don't you take the ships? I'm quite happy to send them to your country. And so the migrant issue, which in principle, I would say, is easier than the euro.
Right.
Easier in the sense that you can do a system of cash compensation over there. You can say, look, the migrants are coming through Italy. We realize that the Italians cannot bear the entire burden. But, you know, and there are state countries like Hungary who are not willing to take migrants. But perhaps they are willing to contribute in some kind of financial way to dealing with this. So in principle, you can construct a system which is equitable to all. But in the euro, as you began your questioning, there is no way to resolve it. I mean, it is inherent.
Right.
The division is inherent in a single currency. And as we just were discussing, because we cannot create a fiscal union, that inherent difference will continue. Just to give you an example right now, at this moment, the Italians have a real interest rate of 1.5%. What is a real interest rate? The nominal interest rate that you pay when you borrow minus the inflation rate. And we minus the inflation rate because a lower interest rate helps us to repay our debt easier, but so does higher inflation because the value of debt goes down. So the Italians have a plus 1.5% real interest rate. The Germans have a negative 1.5% in real interest rate. So, and that is not an accident. That is in the nature of how a monetary union works. So you have Italy, which is therefore almost perpetually, already a weak economy becomes weaker and therefore is always on the threshold of a crisis. And, you know, I call Italy the fault line of the Eurozone, because Italy has very deep, historically long-term economic problems. It's a state which has had very deep political fragmentation, and it is always so large in terms of its financial vulnerabilities that it could at any moment have a crisis which becomes difficult to control.
In your book, you break down the euro from a variety of different time frames, and I wanted to get the sense that you have of the euro and its place in the spectrum of currency, both pre-recession and post-recession.
So when we are talking about the recession, you're thinking about the 2007 to 2009 recession?
Correct. Yeah, correct.
Very good. So that's a very, very interesting question. So we go into the 2007 recession with most people believing that the euro and the dollar are strong currencies, strong in some broad sense that they're backed by important central banks, and these central banks are equally have equal weight in some sense. What happens during the course of the Great Recession between 2007 and 2009 is that the Federal Reserve acts quickly and decisively.
Yep.
The ECB has got an ideological bias towards preventing inflation. So they see the ghost of inflation everywhere. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to imply this in a facetious way, but there is sort of a general aversion to the idea that inflation might spark and create a great deal of damage. This comes from a history of inflation in Germany in particular during the interwar period. So instead of acting to stimulate the economy, they actually tighten monetary policy in 2008, and they continue to act in a slow way. I call it denial that there is a problem, delays, and then half measures. So by 2013, as this process is unfolding, the U.S. has acted aggressively, both in terms of monetary policy and rehabilitating banks. The Europeans have acted slowly, and so they've lost ground. Lost ground not just in the sense of economic recovery, but in the sense of your question, which is that in my view, by 2013, 2014, the European Central Bank becomes a much less effective bank. And by now, in my judgment, the European Central Bank has an interest rate, policy interest rate, which guides market interest rates, a policy interest rate close to zero. And it has run out of tools to deal with the next recession, which may in fact be around the corner. So in the hierarchy of global central banks, the Federal Reserve remains the world's most important central bank, in some sense the world's central banker, because it manages the dollar, which is a dominant currency, but also because it acts in a preemptive way. It has a first mover advantage and therefore sets global interest rate policy. The Bank of Japan is similar to that of the European Central Bank in the sense that it has also tended to act late and with half measures. So there is a deflationary tendency in Japan, but Japan has other advantages like higher productivity growth, and the Bank of Japan can continue to act without the limits that are imposed on the European Central Bank. Remember, the European Central Bank is not a normal central bank.
Right.
It is a bank of a confederation of states, as we were discussing,
right,
who bring their different perspectives. Therefore, today, if there is a recession in the Eurozone, the question will be asked, in whose interest will it act? And if it turns out that there's an Italian recession, there will be a big question mark, because in the process of buying bonds to reduce interest rates in Europe, the ECB already owns 22% of Italian government bonds. And if further support of Italy requires the ECB to own 40% of Italian government bonds, then the ECB will in effect begin to own Italy at that point. And that is technically possible, but is politically a huge question mark, which will prevent, in my reading, the ECB acting.
Mario Draghi ends his term leading the ECB coming up in October. What do you think his legacy becomes then, having to deal with all of these different components and all of these different philosophies?
Look, Mario Draghi is going to be a very important historical figure for one important reason, which is that in July of 2012, when the Eurozone was on the verge of a crisis that could have broken it up, he, with the active support of Chancellor Angela Merkel, made a very famous announcement that may be familiar to your listeners, that the ECB will do whatever it takes to save the Eurozone. Those words had a sort of resounding effect. Investors believed those words, even though there was no action actually taken. And those words pacified markets, interest rates came down, and the Eurozone sense of crisis passed, and it moved into a much more slow crisis rather than one that was likely to inflame and lead to catastrophe. But thereafter, Mario Draghi has become captive, in my view, of the nature of the Confederation of States Central Bank, which is that he was not able to introduce the bond purchase program in time,
right,
and he's leaving now an ECB that is basically at the end of its rope. He's leaving an ECB that will not be able, however much the ECB will protest, they will say that we can do X, Y, Z. But in effect, they've reached a point where if there is anything more than a mild recession, the ECB's tools will prove ineffective in dealing with them. This is not a Mario Draghi problem.
Right.
This is my only sort of concern is that Mario Draghi is sometimes treated as a European saint for that one action that he took, important though it is. But he could not solve the essential problem that we've been discussing, because nobody could.
Yeah.
And so he leaves an ECB that has nothing to offer once he leaves.
Thank you for coming on. It's a pleasure talking with you. And hopefully we can do this again in the near future, because there's so much more to discuss. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ashok Modi from Princeton University. His book, by the way, Euro Tragedy, A Drama in Nine Acts. It's available in hardcover right now. It'll be available in paperback out in 2020.
For more insight from Knowledge at Wharton, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.